It is 21 minutes past the hour. It being a Tuesday morning, we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don, a biochemist and member of the Board of Creation Moments, and he comes to us from Garden Valley, Texas, which is just a little slice of heaven there, a little just a fur piece east of Dallas-Fort Worth and north of where we are here, in kind of northeast of where we are. How's life in Garden Valley today, Don?
Well, it's bright and sunny, and it looks like the air is still, and the temperature says 75 at the moment, but going up to about 92.
Okay.
The rest of the day.
Grapes are going to love it, I think. Grapes love warm temperatures.
Yeah, they're going to be growing like crazy.
Okay. And you've told us before that the vineyard is in a sabbatical year, or kind of a Sabbath year. Tell us about that. What's the thought behind that?
Well, it's the seventh growing year, so Leviticus 25 actually describes the Sabbath year for fields. It actually starts off with the vineyard. You shall pretty much leave your vineyard alone on the seventh year to allow the vines to rest and allow the earth to rest.
So it basically means no harvest then.
No harvest.
Okay.
Yes.
But you're still tending to bugs and weeds and stuff. I know there's still work to do out there.
Oh, there's still work to do, unfortunately. Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And we're not necessarily redesigning the whole trellis system, but we're adding additional catch wires so that next year when the vines grow, we will have the shoots going straight up as opposed to leaning over, which blocks the sun as well as blocks the spray from getting to the grapes.
Then you have to bend over to pick the grapes. This should make it easier on backs.
A little bit. Some of the trellises are higher than others, but
you have to pick grapes by hand, don't you? Or do they have machines in the big vineyards that harvest them now?
Well, they have machines.
Oh, wouldn't you know?
We have hands, but they have machines.
Well, that should go on your label then. You know, hand picked.
Yeah, hand picked.
I think so.
Hand processed. Everything is hand.
Yeah. Dr. Don has been a scientist, still is a scientist, because his skills as a biochemist are still much in demand for his winery business. And we've talked a number of times about the history of science here, and one of the giants, one of the huge figures in the history of science is Sir Isaac Newton. And there's all kinds of stories and legends and myths that him, sitting under a tree and an apple falls and he discovers gravity. Oh, that must have been gravity. You know, we take shortcuts in explaining. I'm thinking.
I like that version.
It could have been a fig tree, and a fig fell. I would have been like that because it would make a small noise. And he said, "No, I'm being too facetious."
That's where fig Newtons came.
That's exactly where fig Newtons came from.
So everybody thought it was an apple, but it was really a fig.
I think so.
But we put it between two slices of pastry, and
he invented the fig.
There
Newton.
It goes.
Yep. and the rest is history, as they say. But the real substance to Newton are his writings, his philosophy, which was Christian in essence, although it says here in the article that he's best described as a non-Trinitarian monotheist, that his view of God bordered on deism. What is deism? How does it differ from the established or traditional view of God and the Trinity?
Well, you're asking a non-theologian here, in essence. It is the belief in the existence of a supreme being. Okay, so that part is good. Specifically, of a creator who does not intervene in the universe.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well,
the term is used chiefly on an intellectual movement in the 17th, 18th centuries.
Yeah, but it captured a lot of people, Thomas Jefferson, one of them who could be numbered in that group, but it says bordering on deism, so there must have been some some fine lines between the traditional view of God and the deist view of God. And I imagine that that term now represents a full spectrum of beliefs. But he believed in, as other scientists did in the early years of science, and by the early years, I mean like the first 150 years of the Age of Enlightenment and the Industrial Age, scientists studied science, employed the scientific method to discover how God works, did they not?
Well, they did, because it was the whole idea that everything is ordered. If you, you know, it try to come up with the concept that everything is disordered and describe it mathematically, which is really what Newton's great contributions in science was. I mean, he discovered calculus and used calculus, for example, to describe the laws of gravity and many other things. We attribute a whole class of mechanics to him called Newtonian mechanics, and the force, for example, and work, and all of that acceleration,
momentum. It was a law, and it took calculus to. I remember that from high school calculus. That was one of the most beautiful things in school I ever discovered was calculus, and I was frankly pretty good at it. Now, I couldn't do it now. It's been a while.
Oh, I'm sure it'd come back quickly.
But that was one of the building blocks in my faith was that discovery. Math itself is an astounding field of study. To think that it's a language that God gave us to understand how things work. And it's so precise. I mean, mathematics, that it's astounding is the word. And calculus, one of the most beautiful iterations of it. And Newton, of course, responsible for that. And his work laid the basis for newer things like quantum mechanics, did it not?
It did. Now, you know, of course, and even, you know, Einstein's relativity and special relativity, in certain areas, especially when it describes gravity, for example, in the simplest form, it boils down to Newton's equations. of course, they're much more complex because they're dealing with either extreme relationships, for example, between gravitational objects or the minute subatomic level with the quantum mechanics, but both kind of start off with the with Newtonian mechanics and then kind of work from there, either on a macro scale or a micro scale. Mm-hmm. And so we couldn't really have quantum mechanics or Einstein relativity without having the work that Newton did with the mechanics that he put together.
There's a telling sentence here that I'm going to read from this article that we're referring to on Newton. Newton understood that nature manifests design of the highest order, and that science, properly understood, and I repeat, that science, properly understood, is the study of the intelligent design of the universe. And tell us some more about that point of view. I mean, that echoes the origins of science. Was that not the motivating factor
it was Newton's motivating factor. Yeah. I mean, if things are ordered, which obviously they are, and not just thrown together, then you can describe it mathematically. If things are not ordered, not predictable, then what's the point of describing it mathematically? Because what you see today is not going to be what you see tomorrow.
But it means those early scientists had the perception of order in what otherwise, maybe what most of the human race saw as chaos and coincidence. And they said, no, there's order here. And they set out to prove that.
And they did prove it. And of course, Newton wasn't the only one that fell into this category. We look at, a number of scientists of that day, Copernicus, for example, to Galileo, to Kepler, to Faraday, to Pasteur, to Maxwell, and even to Einstein himself. They all believed in a God. As a matter of fact, Einstein, one of Einstein's famous quotes had to do with his arguments, his constant letters back and forth with Niels Bohr. And Niels Bohr, you know, of course, described the hydrogen atom and came up with the quantum theories initially. And Niels Bohr was led to the concept of a statistical model, as opposed to being able to describe the location of the electron in a precise way. And Einstein kind of came back and said, "Well, you know, God doesn't play dice with the universe. I mean, it's got to be ordered." And it can't be random, and we can't just say that, well, probably the electron's going to be here. He felt very strongly that you should be able to describe it fully. Well, subsequent work turned out that, well, you can either know its position, but not its direction or speed, or you can know its speed, but not its position. So, that was when you get down into the microcosm of that type of space, things are a little strange indeed. But only because they're strange, because if you take the point of view of Genesis being more literal than we could ever possibly imagine, for example, in Genesis 1. It talks about, and God spoke. And so when God spoke, he said, for example, let there be light. And there was light. And then he separated the light from the darkness. Well, is that a literal speaking? Is God literally speaking into something? I believe he is, and I believe that when he spoke into this substance, which he first created, which was space-time, the space-time continuum that we live in and that we know as the physical world. But when you break down the physical world, especially in the quantum areas, you discover, one, that it's made up of packets, that it's quantized, that it's not a continuous type of structure. It's more like a fabric. And so when we talk about the fabric of space, for example, that's a pretty good description of what space is at the very, very tiny levels. And then secondly, we want to run into this problem of light, which has no mass, but it has vibrations. It has a wavelength, for example. So it's a vibrations, and it's vibrations in space. And so when God says, let there be light, and he actually spoke, is it possible then that when he spoke, he actually caused the vibrations in this space-time continuum, which indeed wound up being light. And then from light built up all of the subatomic particles that we know of today. And then that, of course, building up into the atomic particles that we know, starting with hydrogen all the way up through the very, very heavy metals that we know of. So when you look at it from that point of view, then it's even more amazing, when you take the biblical description and you marry it with what we actually understand, space to be and our physical world to be, it's not a contradiction in terms, but it reinforces what we're seeing actually in those, especially the subatomic levels.
And another factor here, of course, that you have to recognize is this is the realm of spirit imposing order and design on the physical realm. Two different realms of existence here. And if you don't mind my waxing metaphysical for a minute here, there's a similar pattern in the way human ideas are conceived and promulgated and the kind of action that's created. If you come up with an idea, a good idea, that makes sense to people and has benefit to people, somehow, sooner or later, somebody's going to hear that idea via the use of language and create something which would be the physical representation of that idea. You know, whether it's a steam engine or a broadcast station, a radio station with the RF frequencies going out, or chemical developments, the process of going from concept to idea to a physical iteration of that idea is similar, and I think is instructive to us in how that system worked in the beginning.
Well, very much so, and Newton himself, I mean, he kind of got the ball rolling, if you will, with his Newtonian mechanics, which, of course, we build every structure, that every building is based on that mechanics, so that, you know, once we understood how things work together and structures work together, yes, we've refined it with various types of, more sophisticated, if you will, mathematics, but it's based on the same principles, that when you have a force, there's an equal but opposite force that has to be, you know, exerted against it if you're going to have a stationary structure, for example. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we've got the force of gravity working on buildings, and then how do you wind up building a building or moving a locomotive? How much energy do you need in order to move a locomotive? Well, you know, that has to do with work. So all of the, in that, you know, those very concepts that Newton kind of worked out in the, you know, way back then, we use so often today, and it's like, okay, you know, this is just part of the tool set that we use in order to do things that we're doing, you know, now. Even mm-hmm. putting a man on the moon, for example, had to use those same type of principles in order to get him there, and of course get him back, or get them back, for example. So it's all integrated into our society, and you know, sometimes we just don't we just take it for granted that this has always been around, and yes, we know how to do this and we know how to do that, and all of this was created by someone or some group of people who did not believe in God at all, and that is absolutely not the case. And we couldn't have the things that we have today without first having the premise that there was an intellectual designer who designed everything from the very beginning so that we could understand it, mathematically describe it, and then put it to use in various other forms to be creative. Like we were indeed created initially, that was that we are created in the image of God himself.
And isn't it so like us, like humans, to be caught up in the here and now and lose contact with the beginnings? No concept of how we got to where we are. Lack of historical knowledge, I suppose, but Newton was a founder of among others, you named some of those scientists, who kicked off the so-called Age of Enlightenment and has resulted now in tremendously, rapidly changing technology. And, you know, it's hard to say now, if you look at nanotechnology and some of the things that are just around the corner, computers the size of a cell, you know, human cell, that would be incorporated into paint, for example. So they would organize themselves on your wall, and you could your structure would you'd literally be living in a virtual house. All kinds of astounding things that have yet to come, but it all started back then. And here's a question for you: were there scientists 2,000 years ago, even though they might not have had the word or the scientific method had yet to be spoken or enunciated? Were there scientists?
Let's see. You broke up a little bit, so I don't know if it's okay. On my end or your end, but were there scientists 2,000 years ago? Well, that's just look at the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
for example, which were before 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Look at the pyramids. You couldn't have built a pyramid without having some mathematical background on how to do it and the fantastic engineering of how to put it together. So even you know, leveling of the giant stones that were carved, how did they do that? You know, well, they had water levels, for example. So they used water as a level and leveled the buildings, leveled the pyramids. How did you, enclose the pyramid once you've got your prince in there or king in there? How did you close it from the outside world? Well, they had sand tunnels throughout the structure, and the weight of the bricks, for example, the weight, not of the bricks, but of the stones, then when you open the door to let the sand out, the stones would actually, you know, fall into place and lock into place. Hmm. I mean, this just didn't happen by, you know, happenstance. I mean, somebody had to think this stuff up. And so, man was intelligent even way back then.
But intelligent, you could see them making use of gravitational force without understanding what brings about gravitational force, you know, mass and so forth. They would just naturally see how to develop tools and techniques to take advantage of the natural forces that they had to work with.
Right, but not necessarily developing the mathematics per se. Although the Egyptians were, they developed a battery, for example. They did cataract surgery. So they were doing things that, were far advanced to what we would say. And here's a culture that, by the evolutionary, the point of view, for example, should have been dumber than dumb. Mm-hmm. But indeed, we see the evidence of even great intellect in that society. So it's not, I hate to say this again, but it's not like man was evolving. It's like man was devolving from those that time into now. So he was indeed intelligent. Man was intelligent. He was working with the stuff around him, and building fantastic structures that we even marvel at today.
Mm-hmm. And those are the people on whose shoulders we stand.
And, yes,
there was tremendous energy and skill and talent and resourcefulness back then. Now, sometimes we tend to discredit. I want to kind of finish with a quote from Newton here. He wrote the following: "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent being. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all. And on account of his dominion, he is wont to be called Lord God, universal ruler. The supreme God is a being eternal, infinite, absolutely perfect." I think Newton knew what he was talking about. Yeah.
I believe so. I think absolutely.
Dr. Don Clark, member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to make mention of their website. It's creationmoments.com. And if you go there, you'll follow us. There's a new site brewing. They'll have that sometime in the near future. But there's still a wealth of scientific information there, resources in terms of articles and DVDs and all kinds of communication on the scientific developments, the science that supports the biblical creation story. And we recommend a visit to creationmoments.com. Dr. Don Clark, thank you for your time and talent and expertise and just for you today. Nice to have you around. We'll see you next week.
Well, it's nice. It was nice being here, and yes, indeed, we'll talk again next week.
Have a good one.
Well done, Don. Thank you.